Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll hear about Glacier Valley Rotary's Polio Plus Fun Run on Saturday. KXLL's Annie Bartholomew will highlight this Friday's Zombie Walk. We'll discuss Thursday's community discussion on racism, retribution, and religion. And Richard Paisley and Jim Clark will be here with a preview of this weekend's Juno World Affairs Council Forum on Water. Those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. It's currently 49 degrees at the Juno Airport, 48 in Hoonah, and 48 in Gustavus.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The First Nation and youth vote is being credited for the upset this week in Canada's national election. The Conservatives, under Stephen Harper, were defeated at the polls by the Liberals led by Justin Trudeau, the son of a former prime minister. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, some analysts say the Liberals were helped by a widespread desire by voters to get rid of Harper.
In some Aboriginal ridings across the country, voter turnout is reported to have spiked by about 20%. Native leaders say that turnout helped to drive Stephen Harper's Conservatives from office after nearly 10 years in power. Many of them are now optimistic about a new, more respectful relationship with Ottawa. Derek Nepenak, the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, called it a great day.
We do make an impact. We can impact the bottom line on what's happening. And I believe that Mr. Harper, when he was Prime Minister, awoke a sleeping giant in our people, and that giant is awake.
A record 10 Indigenous candidates have now been elected to the Canadian Parliament. Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, voted for the first time and says Justin Trudeau campaigned on a promise of change and a better relationship with Native people, and that's why so many of them also voted for the first time.
Our young people just said, look, the status quo is not acceptable. We're tired of the crappy housing we live in. We're tired of the caps on education. We've got to bring about a change. You know, we've had high numbers of people churning out to the polls, and that's a positive indication of the excitement. But the real willingness was to drive forward that change.
Many of Canada's Indigenous people woke the day after the election with a sense of relief and optimism. They have high expectations of a new Liberal government, and chiefs have a list of issues they want addressed. At the top is an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Bush Foundation has awarded about $7 million in grants to boost education initiatives in South Dakota. The awards aim to add the number of Native American teachers and increase the number of language teachers. Charles Michael Ray has more.
Robert Cook is an Oglala Sioux tribal member who leads the Native Achievement Initiative for Teach for America. The organization recruits top-tier college graduates and professionals to become educators in high-need areas. Teach for America received a $2 million grant from the Bush Foundation to boost the number of Native teachers in South Dakota. Cook says the organization started with 17 teachers in 2004. Today, he says, there are over 100 educators across the state.
The grant's going to really help us to drive our recruitment of Native teachers, and hopefully to matriculate them into the classrooms to serve in tribal schools across South Dakota, but also to support our Native and non-Native teachers in becoming, you know, stronger teachers in the culturally responsive pedagogy.
The Sisseton Wahpeton Sioux Tribe also won a $1 million grant from the Bush Foundation to turn out more Lakota and Dakota language instructors. The group Technology and Education with the Black Hills Special Services Cooperative received a $4 million grant to boost customized education that fits with students' culture and learning styles. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Alaska Native Iditarod champion John Baker, along with state and congressional leaders, announced a wellness initiative last week. The effort is to address issues such as drug abuse, depression, violence, and suicide among Alaska Native people. Baker says change will take a unified grassroots effort.
We must ask, how have we allowed this to become acceptable or even commonplace? We must ask, how can we help make things right? And then, together, we must act to make things right.
Baker and the officials discussed wellness during a panel session at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention in Anchorage. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting,
the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
The Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma features Choctaw-made merchandise, online at ChoctawStore.com. You can own a piece of Choctaw culture delivered to your door, whether it's the works of Choctaw artists, unique apparel, accessories for your home or office, music, videos, and books, including the Choctaw language books. You can find it at ChoctawStore.com. ChoctawStore.com is proud to support Native Voice One.
Native Voice One, the Native American radio service.
You're tuned in to a Juneau Afternoon here on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and our first guest on the show today is Keith Herman. He's the foundation chairman of the Glacier Valley Rotary Club. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Well, thank you, Scott. Yes. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on the show. This Saturday, you guys are going to be having your Polio Plus Fun Run. It starts at River Bend. Tell us more about it.
Well, this is our first annual Polio Plus Fun Run. We're trying to come up with a way to do a fundraiser that's a lot of fun for the community. And we came up with this idea of doing this. As you may know, Polio Plus is a cause that Rotary's been supporting for about 30 years and, you know, has in the course of that 30 years has immunized 2.5 billion kids worldwide in 122 countries. I mean, this is just a huge project. It's this $100 million challenge that's just been going on for decades. And we're just this close.
It's working.
Yeah.
That's great.
We're this close to just eradicating polio worldwide. And I'm just so excited about that. We've only got a couple countries left to go. And so for me, this is all about making a difference in the world. And so we wanted to get together and have the community go out and have a run. And I know there's some racers out there that want to do that 5K and go for their personal record or, you know, beat their friends. And for the rest of us, I'm just going to go for a walk. You know, I'm going to do that 1 mile walk, and it's going to be a fun chance to get together with friends and neighbors and support a great cause.
Yeah, so this is going to be fun. Were you saying registration's at 9 on
Saturday?
Yeah,
we're going to start the registration about 9 a.m. at Riverbend Elementary School out in the playground. And the race will start at 10. So we're hoping to have a great turnout. And regardless of the weather, you know, we're going to be out there having a good time.
And for folks who may not know, there's a couple elementary schools in the valley, but Riverbend is the one kind of by the new high school, right there?
Right.
Riverside
it's near Thunder
Drive.
Mountain High School at Diamond Park. And we're going to be out on the playground at the covered playground area for our start.
Okay. And you had some statistics you were telling me about before we got on the air, something about numbers, how much they've decreased. Remind me of those.
Well, if you go back and look at the history of disease in the whole world, there's only one time in history that mankind has eliminated a disease entirely, and that's smallpox. But now with polio, you know, 30 years ago, polio was hitting maybe 400,000 kids a year. And, you know, when somebody gets polio, as I understand it, you know, I'm no doctor, but they're either paralyzed or they're dead for life, you know, they're dead for life. Yeah, that's a great saying, Keith. Anyway. But they're paralyzed, and it's truly tragic. And, you know, after 30 years of effort, you know, 2.5 billion kids immunized later, we're now down to just a handful. And I don't know the exact number, but I think it was somewhere like 12 cases of polio last year. I mean, we're truly just right at the verge of making history. And I'm just feeling like if Juneau can turn out and support a fundraiser like this and join with other fundraisers like this all across the country, across the world, that we're able to put this disease into the history books as one that's gone forever. And
yeah,
to me, that's just exciting.
And remind me how many immunizations we can get for just $20?
Well, a $20 donation is enough once it's matched to immunize 100 kids. And just to be clear, this is, you know, everything that we're doing at this fundraiser, everything we raise is going to be matched 2-to-1 by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So that $20 donation is going to end up with $60 going to Polio Plus. Every dollar we raise ends up $3 going into the pot. And it's just, this is exciting. I mean, the Gates Foundation stepping forward and offering this matching, double matching, is, I think it's just unprecedented. It's a chance for everyone to be part of this.
Keith, you seem very passionate about this. Why is that?
You know, I've wanted all my life to be somehow engaged in making a difference in the world. And I've traveled to some of the poorest places, from Haiti to Uganda. And, you know, I've seen the real difficulties that are out there in so many poor countries. And in so many cases, it just takes a tiny little bit of effort to make a huge difference. And this polio effort right now has been an ongoing effort. But right now, we're this close to finishing the job. And it's just, you know, just a little bit more effort, and it'll push us over the line and put this in the history books. And I'm excited about that.
Okay. Keith, tell us a little bit more about Glacier Valley Rotary and how we can find you on the interweb.
Well, on the interwebs, let's see. I suppose it's probably GlacierValleyRotary.com or .org, one of the two.
And you're one of three Rotary clubs, right?
We do. We have three Rotary clubs here in Juneau. We've got the downtown Juneau Rotary Club, the Juneau Gastineau Rotary Club, and the Glacier Valley Rotary Club.
How else do you guys like to spend your time?
Well, there's a lot of fellowship. You know, we have a lot of fun with our friends. But what we're really all about is service. And so we're engaged in local service projects. You know, let's see, some of the things we've worked on this year, we helped rebuild that playground at Riverbend Elementary School that just opened up last month, I believe. We helped put in a new commercial kitchen at the Zach Gordon Youth Center. We're currently engaged in a big food drive to restock the food pantry. We're helping with high school students learning about service. We have international exchange students in our local high schools every year, and we send our local high school students abroad. So, for example, right now the Glacier Valley Rotary Club has an exchange student that we sent to Finland. So these are some of the efforts that we're engaged in locally. You know, I mentioned I went to Uganda. Well, that was part of a Rotary group that went last year. And, you know, a lot of people have probably heard about that trip. We were able to take a group of students from Thunder Mountain High School with us to Uganda and get engaged in a variety of service projects there. We've got a group coming up to go to Mexico to help with Project Amigo coming up in January. I think we've got 25 local Rotarians that are going to be on that trip. And, you know, we just local service projects, international service projects, and having a lot of fun together. To me, that's what Rotary is all about.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. It sounds like you're busy. If somebody wanted to get involved with Rotary, how should they do that?
Well, if you go to Rotary.org, there's a couple of buttons right on the homepage there, like find a local Rotary club, contribute today, or find out what it takes to join a local Rotary club.
Okay. Or they could probably come meet you on Saturday.
We'll be there Saturday. Absolutely.
Remind us the details of that again.
Well, it's the Polio Plus Fun Run. Registration is going to start Saturday morning, 9 a.m. at Riverbend Elementary. And the race is going to start at 10. And we got, a 5K run for those serious runners, or a one-mile walk for the rest of us.
All right. Keith Herman, he's the foundation chairman for the Glacier Valley Rotary Club. Anything else you want to add, Keith? Think we got it?
I think that's it.
All right. We'll see you on Saturday. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 21st of October, 2015. It's the birthday of Ursula K. Le Guin, born in Berkeley, 1929. Her mother was a psychologist. Her father was an anthropologist, Alfred Kroeber, sometimes called the Dean of American Anthropologist. He researched Native American cultures. And so Ursula grew up with Native American myths. When she was young, over the course of 10 years, she wrote 5 novels, none of which were published. Publishers thought the writing was too remote. So she began to write science fiction. And in the genre of science fiction and fantasy, she's been incredibly prolific for the last 4 decades. Publishing more than 100 short stories, 20 novels, 11 children's books, best known for her Earthsea books, a fantasy series taking place in a world populated by wizards and dragons. Ursula Le Guin's advice to writers was to stay focused, and if you have a hard time staying focused, maybe you shouldn't be writing what you're writing. If you lack motivation, maybe writing is not what you should be doing. If writing bores you, that's pretty fatal. It was on this day, 1879, Thomas Edison finally hit on the idea for a workable electric light. People have been trying to make them since the 1820s. They'd chosen the wrong material for the filament. They chose platinum. And Edison tried carbonized cotton thread, a carbon filament that worked very well, and then he came up with a tungsten filament that lasted even longer. One of the effects of the invention of the electric light is that people sleep less than they used to. They used to sleep about 9 hours a night. Since then, it's been about 7.5, and sleep researchers show that if people are deprived of electric light, they'll go back to 9 hours a night. It's the birthday of the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, born in Devonshire, England, 1772, author of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, about a sailor who brings a curse on the ship after he kills an albatross. Coleridge once dreamed of starting a utopian village along the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, a place where there would be no aristocracy. He was under the influence of the French Revolution. But he never went to Pennsylvania. Instead, he got married to a woman named Sarah Fricker, and the two of them moved to a little house in the country where he had a vegetable garden and where he met the poet William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy, who liked to take long walks in the nearby hills. And that was where Coleridge came up with the idea for his famous poem. Here's a poem by Emily Dickinson, a poem entitled As Imperceptibly as Grief. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away, too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. A quietness distilled as twilight, long begun, or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. The dusk drew earlier in, the morning foreign shone, a courteous yet harrowing grace as guest that would be gone. And thus, without a wing or service of a keel, our summer made her light escape into the beautiful. As Imperceptibly as Grief, poem by Emily Dickinson. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The zombies are back, and they're ready to party.
Meet us 7:30 p.m., Friday, October 23rd, in the Cope Park parking lot for the KXLL Zombie Walk.
When Juno's undead will stalk the streets of Juno in a flesh-eating flash mob.
Then dance the night away at the Taqueria, where Alaskan Scorchers DJ Taco Todd will be spinning an all-vinyl set of ska, rock, steady, and soul music.
With prizes for funniest zombie, most undead, and best celebrity zombie.
It'll be a hair-raising good time.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. Scott Burton, your host, and joining me now, all the way over from the KXLL studios, Annie Bartholomew. She's the program director and arts, culture, and music producer and organizer of this Friday's Zombie Walk. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Thanks, Scott.
It's getting close. T-minus like 2 days.
I know. I'm super excited. My fake blood just arrived yesterday, so took it out for a spin and a photo shoot.
Yeah, how'd it go? You're down at Copa taking some pictures.
So I didn't expect the blood to be as realistic as it was.
And you're not a big blood person, right?
No, I always faint whenever I get blood tests. It's like really embarrassing because, you know, they'll have people in like a line at Valley Medical and I'll be the girl who like needs a snack. And it's so sad. But yeah, I get really lightheaded when I take it off. But yeah, we went to Copa, me and Patty Kalbrenner took some photos. We thought like, let's go, you know, in the afternoon when it's like really quiet. And of course it was packed with like federal employees and neighborhood people. And I was just there in my blood.
You did okay, because we don't want the leader of the zombie walk fainting on Friday night.
Yeah, I did okay this time. That's the nice thing is, like, you can't look in the mirror when you have it on. You just gotta embrace it. And it helps to act out a little bit, or else people think you're, like, battered or something.
Okay.
This poor guy walked in. He's like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I'm just here for the photo shoot. You could buy me a cup of coffee, sir.
So why Zombie Walk? It's, what, 5 years now?
5 years running, yeah. Andy Klein started the event a long time ago. I've always been at college, so I've missed it. But this is going to be my first year. And it's just a really cool event for us to show our KXLL spirit to the community. And it's kind of a flash mob. Zombies like to travel in packs, terrorizing, respectfully, the neighborhood of downtown Juneau. There's been some problems in the past of people, like, pulling people out of cars and rubbing their bloody faces on shop windows. And that's not going to happen this year. We're specifically avoiding Franklin Street just so there aren't the temptations, you know. There's always a temptation for brains, but this year where you can look, but you can't touch.
What have you communicated to your zombies about self-control this year?
You know, just... what would you do if you were working in the shop? You know, that was one thing I heard, because I went to a lot of people in the community when I got into this event, and I said, you know, what's worked well in the past, what hasn't, and then one of my friends who worked in the food service industry said, like, it's kind of a drag when you have to clean up the fake blood on the windows outside, so we're going to meet up in the Cope Park parking lot at 7:30, and we're going to have a safety talk. About appropriate zombie behavior. You know, it's fine to, like, act weird and moan and groan.
Probably hands to yourself, though, right?
Yeah, hands to yourself.
No eating brains.
Yeah, I mean...
fake ones, maybe.
BYOB, bring your own brains. That works. Unfortunately, it's an all-ages event, so everyone's invited. I got the cast of Meet Me in St. Louis, the recent JDHS play. Those kids to voice it that you heard earlier. So we really want to encourage the spirit of people coming out, having a good time. Our after parties at the Taqueria, a restaurant, and an Alaskan Scorcher, DJ Taco Todd, who does really, really fun music, is going to be spinning his first all-vinyl set. So
wow.
I'm super excited. This is kind of my dream come true. It's not even Halloween. It's like part one Halloween.
Why are zombies so popular these days? Do you think we were trying to figure this out earlier?
You know, it's kind of everywhere. I mean, I see how my friends love the episodic Walking Dead television series, but also the comic book series. And I think it's kind of a form of escapism. You get to kind of envision the end of the world away from your mundane life of paperwork or whatever you do and really fighting for your life, like really living it. Why do you think?
Oh, no, I think that's right on point. Sort of also mimicking sort of programmed style life and you know, it emulates that. Perhaps getting away from that, I don't know. But it's so popular in pop culture. Like
it's
you said,
huge.
The Walking
Dead. And
it
hasn't slowed down. That's the thing that I think is crazy, because I first learned about the whole zombie phase. I mean, I think it was my costume my sophomore year of college one night to be a zombie, and it hasn't slowed down a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Zombie Walk this Friday at 7:30. Hey, how's life over at KXLL?
Oh, it is excellent as always.
Good.
If you've seen me around town, I've been kind of stressed out lately because we are going through all of our music right now and trying to freshen it up. So I've probably listened to 15,000 songs in the last few months, which sounds awesome when they're your favorite artist. But some of the genres I don't know as much about, and I'm coming to discover a lot of really cool music. Right now I'm on this like disco funk, 70s boogie soul kind of thing that I think is really awesome, but that's because I didn't live through it. So I'm excited to hear from some of our listeners as people will hear these transition happening on the radio. Sometime in November, we're going to do a listener survey so people can tell us what they think. But I'm hoping to get more towards a friendlier sound, easier to listen to, more newer music, but newer music that you don't have to have a lot of listening experience to appreciate.
Nice. And you run a morning show Monday through Friday, right?
I do. 8-ish to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. And I just kind of play whatever I'm feeling that day, but I get to take a lot of requests, which is fun. 463-6499. If you're listening on your way to work, I really like, I hate to use the word classic rock because I think of like AC/DC or the Stones, which are fabulous, but I like a lot of the deeper cuts. I'm way into garage rock right now, which is kind of making a resurgence in the lower 48. Southern California surf music is huge right now. There's so much cool music that's happening, and I just love sharing it with everyone in Juneau.
Sounds like a good gig.
And if you know anybody who wants to become a DJ on KXLL, my email is Annie, A-N-N-I-E, at KTOO.org, and they could send me a Spotify playlist if they think they're ready to join Team KXLL. But you don't even have to host a radio show to be a volunteer. If you just want to help out with cool events or just be part of the gang, the best way is to shoot me an email.
Or start on Friday night at the Zombie Walk.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited for this, Scott. It's going to be...
Details once more?
7:30 at Cote Park parking lot. And then we'll walk up Calhoun, past the governor's mansion, take a group photo on the Capitol steps, come down Sewer Street, get a little bit of that action, and then head over to the Taqueria. The after party starts around 8 o'clock-ish until close. Get some tacos. Get some brains.
It sounds like a lot of fun. Are we missing anything? Anything else you want to add?
Copa has generally donated some pints of ice cream as prizes for us. Alaska Music One's helping us with the music. DJ Taco Todd is going to be spinning vinyl. It's going to be really awesome.
7:30 on Friday.
Oh, yeah. See, are you coming, Scott?
I'll be there.
Yes.
Cote Park.
midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell.
Programming support comes from Balloons by Night Moods. Now with hundreds of Halloween costumes for rental in a variety of sizes and styles. More information at 523-1099.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. It's about 33 minutes after the hour, and I've been joined on the phone now by Mr. Saul Neely. Dr. Saul Neely, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. Saul, you're going to be a big part of Thursday's community discussion on racism, retribution, and religion. Tell us more about it. Tell us about ANDOR, what that stands for, and your relationship to it.
Okay, well, ANDOR is an acronym that stands for Alaska Native Dialogue on Racial Equity, and it is a program of sorts developed by the First Alaskans Institute. They had, I believe it was a 3-year grant to develop a series of community protocol by which to facilitate some really difficult discussions about historical violence and racism and the vicious legacy of white supremacy. And we had, about 2.5 years ago now, I was part of a panel at the final evening at Egan, and it was on deconstructing racism in Juneau. And that that panel consisted of Ishmael Hope, Lance Twitchell, M.K. McNaughton, Christy Nami Erickson, Pastor Phil Campbell. And our panel, after that evening at Egan, decided that we wanted to continue our work together as a group, and we decided the best way to continue our work was to get this ANDOR training. And so our provost at the time, Rick Caulfield, he's our chancellor now, very generously agreed to fund that training. So his office flew representatives from First Alaskans Institute down here to Juneau to the UAS campus. That was Liz Medicine Crow, Kyle Wark, Darlene Trigg. And we had 2 full days of training, and that included some other faculty members and staff members here on campus, and Ernestine Hayes, Colleen James. And it just offers a set of social technologies by which to facilitate these community dialogues. And we continued with these community dialogues on campus. The ANDOR-style dialogues had a real impact on our campus community. Tomorrow night's event is the first time where we really get to bring UAS community with the broader community together and come out of the safe zone that is our campus environment and into the community and facilitate these kinds of difficult dialogues.
Interesting. Did you call them social technologies?
Yeah, that's the phrase that ANDOR uses.
Okay, and can you give us an example of a couple of these techniques?
Sure. If any of the listeners were at last year's evening at Egan, they got to see some of this in action. So one of my favorites is, it's called Fishbowl. And with a fishbowl, you get a group of interlocutors, people who have a conversation with one another. And, for instance, last year at the evening at Egan, we had a group of Alaska Native Studies students who got in a small group around a table, and they talked about their experiences with racism in the campus community and in the broader community. And there were over 100 people in attendance, and everybody else just sits silently and listens to what they have to say about their experiences with racism in the community. And when you listen, you know, in that way, then you hear testimony about racial experiences that people who enjoy cultural privilege in our community might not have ever experienced. Then there's another one, it's called World Cafe, where you establish a few different groups to have their own private dialogues, and then people are free to get up and to move around to different groups to get a little flavor of each of the group dialogues, and then we reconvene in as a larger group, and we get a very short report back from each of those groups about highlights. And the idea behind these different social technologies, there's about 8 or 9 of them that we were trained in, is at the end, you harvest the collective wisdom of the group. And that's another phrase that comes from Andor, this idea of harvesting the collective wisdom of the group. And that's what we hope to do tomorrow night.
Okay. So remind us what you're a doctor of and what you teach out at UAS.
I'm a professor of philosophy and literature at UAS, and I did my PhD at Purdue University's philosophy and literature program.
Okay, and when are you going to be presenting as part of tomorrow night's discussion?
Well, so I'm going to make a couple provocative claims, some provocative theses, if you will. This summer I presented on part of a panel at a conference at St. Louis University for the Colloquium on Violence and Religion. And it's based, that group, they call themselves Cover, is formed around the work of René Girard. And René Girard makes the argument that at the heart of all of our political institutions is a scapegoating violence, what he calls the sacrificial. So all of our politics, political structures are derived from the sacrificial. Well, this conference this summer was at St. Louis University, literally 8 miles from West Florissant Avenue, which was the epicenter of the Ferguson riots. And so the Cover took up a 5-year study of lynching, and this year it specifically took up lynching studies and the Black Lives Matter movement, since we were right there at Ferguson. And, the argument, the provocative thesis that I made then and that I'm going to make tomorrow night, is that we are accustomed to thinking that racism is incidental or secondary to the formation of the state, but I believe that racism is foundational to the state. And it's foundational in a way that we've never collectively acknowledged, and that frustrates our attempts to root out and heal the wounds of racism and historical violence. And instead of thinking about the state as being born with the cessation of war, right, that somehow that there's a war and then that war comes to an end and the state is born, that the state is actually born and codified in the mud and blood of war. And we see that. We see traces of that in the U.S. Constitution with a 3/5 compromise clause. It's still at work with federal Indian law in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We actually see the state as a codification of a war that is, through the history of the United States, it's been racialized. So it's a provocative claim that I want to make, and that I want to argue that that insofar as racism is foundational to the state, it takes on an aspect of retribution. So you look at our prison system, for instance. I do a lot of work with the prisons. And it's common to point out that the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution doesn't abolish slavery. It just relocates it into the prison system, because the 13th Amendment says there will be no more slavery except for duly convicted criminals. And you look at the overrepresentation of peoples of color in our prison system. Here in Alaska, Alaska Natives make up about 15% of the general population, but they make up over 37% of our prison population. That is a form of sacrificial violence, I argue, a retributive violence that is given alibi by a cultural logic of scapegoating. I actually call it a form of neo-lynching. And so I want to sort of introduce these two provocative theses and then open up a community dialogue about what does retribution look like in our own community here in Juneau and Southeast Alaska, and then what can we do to interrupt these economies of violence that we all sort of get caught up in.
Okay, so this is tomorrow, Thursday, at Northern Lights. It's from 6:30 to 8:30. Saul, who do you think would benefit most by attending this?
That is a really good question. I know that we're going to have some of the folks who regularly attend Northern Light Church there, and some of my students are going to be there. But I would really also like to invite people who are a part of, say, the Department of Corrections, or people who work with the prison system. I would like to see folks who feel, you know, uncomfortable about these kinds of conversations to show up, because the beauty about Andor is it develops social technologies where we have respectful and productive dialogue, and it's grounded on rules. We have rules for the dialogue, and if we all agree to those rules, then the best kinds of conversations emerge.
Okay, Saul Neely, he's going to be a big part of this community discussion on racism, retribution, and religion tomorrow night at Northern Lights Church from 6:30 to 8:30. I'm assuming it's free. Is that right, Saul?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Are we missing anything? Anything you want to add?
I don't think so. If it sounds like a complicated and provocative thesis, well, then please show up and we'll unpack it together.
All right, Saul, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye.
Bye.
Ebony and ivory live together in perfect harmony. Side by side on my piano keyboard. Oh, Lord, why don't we? We all know that people are the same wherever you go. There is good and bad in everyone. Learn to live, learn to give each other what we need to survive, together alive. Ebony and ivory live together in perfect harmony, side by side on my piano keyboard.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. Kind of bring that music down right there. It's about 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and I've been joined in the studio now by Juno World Affairs Council's Jim Clark. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much, Scott. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. And JWAC's guest, Dr. Richard Paisley. You teach at the University of British Columbia in law, and will you take it up from there, Richard, for me?
Sure. I teach international law, but I have particular interest in international water and energy and conflict resolution. So I get to work on international rivers around the world.
Wow, that sounds like fun. Let's get back to that in a minute. Jim, just for in case folks don't know about what JWAC does, can you give us the bio?
Well, the Juno World Affairs Council is a nonpartisan, nonprofit corporation that sole mission is to bring speakers on international subject to Juno, and we've covered topics from Pakistan, the Middle East, Greenland, all over the world. We've had speakers come in and talk to us, and every year we put on a forum with the University of Alaska Southeast that lasts for 3 days. Previously, we've had one on climate change. We've had one on our partnership with Mexico, our partnership with Canada. This time, it's the politics of water. And what we're exploring is the what water shortages will do in terms of regional stability, food production as the planet population grows. And how those matters are resolved, what kind of dispute resolution mechanisms are in place. And that's what Dr. Paisley is here to help people understand in the various sessions we're going to have. It'll be from tomorrow night at the University of Alaska Southeast, the Egan Lecture Hall, and starting at 7 o'clock. And we'll run through Saturday with various sessions, ending on Saturday afternoon.
And I went to your website, and there's a schedule laid out right there.
Exactly.
And check in. Dr. Paisley, you have a background in law and science. So you said as part of your discussions, you're going to try and bridge those two. Tell us a little bit about what we can expect from your lectures.
I'm going to try to draw on my experience, the privilege I've had working throughout the world in Africa and Asia and the Americas, and look at governance of international waters. Turns out that some incredibly high percentage of the, first of all, water is in crisis in the world generally. Some people have called water the new gold. And with climate change and other factors, it's becoming increasingly important to sort of get a handle on the politics of water. And that's why I'm here. But what I'm going to try to do in my lecture is talk about the governance of water and how important governance is to water, and particularly international water. It turns out there are 265 international rivers in the world, and something like in excess of half the population of the planet will be living in those international river basins by the year 2050.
How did you get into this field of study? What drew you to it?
Well, I was originally on the science side of things, and I did a master's degree in resource management, but I guess I became increasingly convinced that the major decisions that were being made to do with water and energy and environment were being made by lawyers and politicians rather than scientists. And so I pretentiously thought that if I could go that direction myself, maybe I could make an important contribution. And so that's what I've tried to do throughout my career.
Jim, I think you've answered this a bit so far, but tell us what inspired you to invite Dr. Paisley here.
Well, we were looking for people around the country who might be able to contribute to the politics of water discussion we've had. We particularly on these kind of things like to get people from the West Coast just because Alaska is more of a West Coast type culture than the East Coast of the United States. And Dr. Paisley was particularly appealing coming from the University of British Columbia and Vancouver, and particularly since one of the issues is transboundary waters, and as you know, we have some issues with respect to transboundary mines here in Southeast Alaska, so we thought it would be of special interest to the to the folks who live here, particularly since his expertise is in dispute resolution, which obviously is going to be something that we'll be needing to resolve the issues with the transboundary mine.
I'm sure you're going to talk about this in detail, Dr. Paisley, but how do our issues, our transboundary issues, compare to other folks around the world?
It's a good question. I'm going to call my talk The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the good that I'm going to use is the examples that exist, some of the examples, at least between Canada and the United States, the most famous of which is probably the Columbia River Treaty, which has been a sort of a the classic example of, you know, cooperation between two adjacent countries. The bad, there's a lot of bad out there, but then there's some really ugly places that I've also had the privilege of working in. Those include Central Asia and Afghanistan, where the politics of water are really intense, and the climatic conditions are such that it's going to become even more intense over time. And the will to try to resolve conflict also seems to be lacking. One of the things that's sort of gratifying about the Canada-U.S. situation is there seems to be goodwill on both sides. So the trick will be to capitalize on it.
Okay, sounds very interesting. Jim, can you give us a quick outline again of when and where the lectures will be?
The lectures will be at the Egan Lecture Hall at the University of Alaska Southeast, starting tomorrow night, Thursday night, the 22nd, at the University of Alaska Southeast Lecture Hall, Egan Lecture Hall. And they'll again continue on Friday. Dr. Paisley will be giving a talk, his talk, at 2 o'clock on Friday at the Egan Lecture Hall. And then Dr. McCaffrey will be doing the evening at Egan that night. And Saturday, we have a number of speakers, and we'll wrap it up with a panel discussion on Saturday afternoon, which we try to see what kind of conclusions we can reach based upon what has been said during the conference.
Okay. And if somebody wants more information, where should they go?
To the JWAC.org website. That's JWAC, JWAC.org. And all of this is posted on the website, as you mentioned.
All right, gentlemen, I think we have it just about covered. Anything you'd like to add?
That it's free. Please come.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
All right. Dr. Richard Paisley and Jim Clark of JWAC, things start up tomorrow night, Thursday night at 7. You guys, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burnt dry and souls that cry for water, cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? It's water, cool, clear water. The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool of water, cool water. But with the dawn, I wake and yawn and carry on to water.
Support comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, offering HydroFit every Tuesday and Thursday from 6:30 p.m. until 7:30. Aqua Aerobics Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. until noon, and Stretch Aquatics Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45. Fall swim schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/rec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. Tomorrow, Joan Pardis will be your host, and we'll learn more about the JWAC and UAS panel on water with Bruce Botello and Stephen McCaffrey, who was mentioned in today's interview. They'll be here. Juno Symphony Fall Concert, we'll hear more about that from Troy Quinn and company. And we'll also hear about Paradise Waits, the Teton Gravity Research film. And from Alaska Powder Descents, Arts Up, those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Thursday on a Juno Afternoon, live at 3 and repeated at 4 on KRNN and available online via KTOO.org. The weather, currently 49 degrees at the Juno Airport. Tonight calls for rain showers becoming heavy at times, lows around 43. Thursday, rain showers, highs around 49, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday, rain showers likely, highs around 45. Saturday and Saturday night, mostly cloudy, highs around 42. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same frequency.